with an uneasy quiet. Then I heard my mother singing something about trains and Arkansas. She came in the back door with some folded yellow curtains, which she piled on the kitchen table. I sat down on the floor to listen to the song's story and noticed how strangely she was behaving. She still had her hat on, and her shoes were dusty, as though she had been walking in deep dirt. She put on some water to boil and then swept the porch. Then she hauled out the curtain stretcher, but instead of putting the damp curtains on it, she swept the porch again, all the time singing about trains and Arkansas. When she finished, I went to look for Frida. I found her upstairs, lying on our bed, crying the tired, whimpering cry that follows the first wailings, mostly gasps and shudderings. I lay on the bed and looked at the tiny bunches of wild roses sprinkled over her dress. Many washings had faded their color and dimmed their outlines. "What happened, Frida?" She lifted a swollen face from the crook of her arm. Shuddering still, she sat up, letting her thin legs dangle over the bedside. I knelt on the bed and picked up the hem of my dress to wipe her running nose. She never liked wiping noses on clothes, but this time she let me. It was the way Mama did with her apron. "Did you get a whipping?" She shook her head no. "Then why are you crying?" "Because."
"Because what?"
"Mr. Henry."
"What'd he do?"
"Daddy beat him up."
"What for?"
"The Maginot Line."
"Did he find out about the Maginot Line?"
"No."
"Well, what then? Come on, Frida. How come I can't know?"
"He picked at me."
"Picked at you? You mean like Soaphead Church?"
"Sort of."
"He showed his privates at you?"
"No.
He touched me."
"Where?"
"Here and here."
She pointed to the tiny breasts that, like two fallen acorns, scattered a few faded rose leaves on her dress.
"Really? How did it feel?"
"Oh, Claudia." She sounded put out. I wasn't asking the right questions.
"It didn't feel like anything."
"But wasn't it supposed to feel good, I mean?"
Frida sucked her teeth.
"What'd he do, just walk up and pinch them?"
She sighed.
"First he said how pretty I was. Then he grabbed my arm and touched me."
"Where was Mama and Daddy?"
"Over at the garden, weeding."
"What'd you say when he did it?"
"Nothing, I just ran out the kitchen and went to the garden.
Mama said we was never to cross the tracks by ourselves."
"Well, what would you do? Sit there and let him pinch you?"
I looked at my chest. "I don't have nothing to pinch. I'm never going to have nothing."
"Oh, Claudia, you're jealous of everything. You want him to?"
"No, I just get tired of having everything last."
"You do not.
What about scarlet fever? You had that first."
"Yes, but it didn't last.
Anyway, what happened at the garden?"
"I told Mama, and she told Daddy, and we all come home, and he was gone, so we waited for him. And when Daddy saw him come up on the porch, he threw our old tricycle at his head and knocked him off the porch."
"Did he die?"
"No. He got up and started singing, 'Nearer My God to Thee.' Then Mama hit him with a broom and told him to keep the Lord's name out of his mouth. But he wouldn't stop, and Daddy was cussing, and everybody was screaming." "Oh, shoot, I always miss stuff." "And Mr. Buford came running out with his gun, and Mama told him to go somewhere and sit down. And Daddy said, 'No, give him the gun.' And Mr. Buford did, and Mama screamed, and Mr. Henry shut up and started running. And Daddy shot at him, and Mr. Henry jumped out of his shoes and kept on running in his socks. Then Rosemary came out, and said that Daddy was going to jail, and I hit her. Real hard. Real hard.
Is that when Mama whipped you?
She didn't whip me, I told you.
Then why are you crying?
Miss Dunyan came in after everybody was quiet, and Mama and Daddy was fussing about who let Mr. Henry in anyway, and she said that Mama should take me to the doctor because I might be ruined. And Mama started screaming all over again.
At you?
No, at Miss Dunyan.
But why were you crying?
I don't want to be ruined.
What's ruined?
You know, like the Maginot Line. She's ruined. Mama said so.
The tears came back. An image of Frieda, big and fat, came to mind. Her thin legs swollen, her face surrounded by layers of rouged skin. I too began to feel tears.
But Frieda, you could exercise and not eat.
She shrugged.
Besides, what about China and Poland? They're ruined too, aren't they? And they ain't fat.
That's because they drink whiskey. Mama says whiskey ate them up.
You could drink whiskey.
Where would I get whiskey?
We thought about this. Nobody would sell it to us. We had no money anyway. There was never any in our house. Who would have some?
Picola, I said.
Her father's always drunk. She can get us some.
You think so?
Sure. Charlie's always drunk. Let's go ask her. We don't have to tell her what for.
Now?
Sure now.
What'll we tell Mama?
Nothing. Let's just go out the back, one at a time, so she won't notice.
Okay. You go first, Claudia.
We opened the fence gate at the bottom of the backyard and ran down the alley. Picola lived on the other side of Broadway. We had never been in her house, but we knew where it was. A two-story gray building that had been a store downstairs and had an apartment upstairs. Nobody answered our knock on the front door, so we walked around to the side door. As we approached, we heard radio music and looked to see where it came from. Above us was the second-story porch, lined with slanting, rotting rails, and sitting on the porch was the Maginot Line herself. We stared up and automatically reached for the other's hand. A mountain of flesh, she lay rather than sat in a rocking chair. She had no shoes on, and each foot was poked between a railing. Tiny baby toes at the tip of puffy feet, swollen ankles smoothed and tightened the skin. Massive legs, like tree stumps, parted wide at the knees, over which spread two rows of soft, flabby inner thigh that kissed each other deep in the shade of her dress and closed. A dark brown root beer bottle, like a burned limb, grew out of her dimpled hand. She looked at us down through the porch railings and emitted a low, long belch. Her eyes were as clean as rain, and again I remembered the waterfall. Neither of us could speak. Both of us imagined we were seeing what was to become of Frieda. The Maginot Line smiled at us.
You all looking for somebody?
I had to pull my tongue from the roof of my mouth to say, Picola, she live here?
Uh-huh, but she ain't here now. She gone to her mama's workplace to get the wash.
Yes, ma'am, she coming back?
Uh-huh,
she gotta hang up the clothes before the sun goes down.
Oh, you can wait for her. Wanna come up here and wait?
We exchanged glances. I looked back up at the broad cinnamon roads that met in the shadow of her dress.
Frieda said, no, ma'am.
Well, the Maginot Line seemed interested in our problem. You can go to her mama's workplace, but it's way over by the lake. Where by the lake?
That big white house with the wheelbarrow full of flowers.
It was a house that we knew, having admired the large white wheelbarrow tilted down on spoked wheels and planted with seasonal flowers.
Ain't that too far for you all to go walking?
Frida scratched her knee.
Why don't you wait for her? You can come up here. Want some pop?
Those rain-soaked eyes lit up, and her smile was full, not like the pinched and holding-back smile of other grown-ups.
I moved to go up the stairs, but Frida said, "No, ma'am, we ain't allowed."
I was amazed at her courage and frightened of her sassiness. The smile of the Maginot line slipped.
"Ain't allowed?"
"No."
"Ain't allowed to what?"
"Go in your house."
"Is that right?"
The waterfalls were still.
"How come?"
"My mama said so. My mama said you ruined."
The waterfalls began to run again. She put the root beer bottle to her lips and drank it empty. With a graceful movement of the wrist, a gesture so quick and small we never really saw it, only remembered it afterward, she tossed the bottle over the rail at us. It split at our feet, and shards of brown glass dappled our legs before we could jump back. The Maginot line put a fat hand on one of the folds of her stomach and laughed. At first, just a deep humming with her mouth closed, then a larger, warmer sound. Laughter at once beautiful and frightening. She let her head tilt sideways, closed her eyes, and shook her massive trunk, letting the laughter fall like a wash of red leaves all around us. Scraps and curls of the laughter followed us as we ran. Our breath gave out at the same time our legs did. After we rested against a tree, our heads on crossed forearms, I said, "Let's go home." Frida was still angry, fighting, she believed, for her life. "No, we gotta get it now. We can't go all the way to the lake."
"Yes, we can. Come on. Mama gonna get us."
"No, she ain't. Besides, she can't do nothing but whip us."
That was true. She wouldn't kill us or laugh a terrible laugh at us or throw a bottle at us. We walked down tree-lined streets of soft gray houses leaning like tired ladies. The streets changed. Houses looked more sturdy. Their paint was newer. Porch posts straighter. Yards deeper. Then came brick houses set well back from the street, fronted by yards edged in shrubbery clipped into smooth cones and balls of velvet green. The lakefront houses were the loveliest. Garden furniture, ornaments, windows like shiny eyeglasses, and no sign of life. The backyards of these houses fell away in green slopes, down to a strip of sand. Then the blue Lake Erie, lapping all the way to Canada. The orange-patched sky of the steel mill section never reached this part of town. This sky was always blue. We reached Lakeshore Park, a city park laid out with rosebuds, fountains, bowling greens, picnic tables. It was empty now, but sweetly expectant of clean, white, well-behaved children and parents who would play there above the lake in summer before half-running, half-stumbling down the slope to the welcoming water. Black people were not allowed in the park, and so it filled our dreams. Right before the entrance to the park was the large white house with the wheelbarrow full of flowers. Short crocus blades sheathed the purple and white hearts that so wished to be first they endured the chill and rain of early spring. The walkway was flagged in calculated disorder, hiding the cunning symmetry. Only fear of discovery and the knowledge that we did not belong kept us from loitering. We circled the proud house and went to the back. There, on the tiny railed stoop, sat Piccola in a light red sweater and blue cotton dress. A little wagon was parked near her. She seemed glad to see us.
"Hi. Hi. What you all doing here?"
She was smiling, and since it was a rare thing to see on her, I was surprised at the pleasure it gave me.
"We're looking for you.
Who told you I was here?" "The Maginot Line."
"Who is that?"
"That big fat lady. She lives over you."
"Oh, you mean Miss Marie."
"Her name is Miss Marie."
"Well, everybody calls her Miss Maginot Line. Ain't you scared?"
"Scared of what?"
"The Maginot Line."
Piccola looked genuinely puzzled.
"What for?
Your mama let you go in her house and eat out of her plates?"
"She don't know I go. Miss Marie is nice. They all nice."
"Oh, yeah," I said. "She tried to kill us."
"Who, Miss Marie? She don't bother nobody."
"Then how come your mama don't let you go in her house if she's so nice?"
"I don't know. She says she's bad, but they ain't bad. They give me stuff all the time."
"What stuff?"
"Oh, lots of stuff. Pretty dresses and shoes. I got more shoes than I ever wear. And jewelry and candy and money. They take me to the movies. And once we went to the carnival. China gonna take me to Cleveland to see the square. And Poland gonna take me to Chicago to see the loop. We going everywhere together."
"You lying. You don't have no pretty dresses."
"I do too."
"Oh, come on, Piccola. What you telling us all that junk for?" Frida asked.
"It ain't junk."
Piccola stood up, ready to defend her words, when the door opened. Mrs. Breedlove stuck her head out the door and said, "What's going on out here? Piccola, who are these children?"
"That's Frida and Claudia, Mrs. Breedlove."
"Whose girls are you?"
She came all the way out on the stoop. She looked nicer than I had ever seen her, in her white uniform and her hair in a small pompadour.
"Mrs. McTeer's girls, ma'am."
"Oh, yes. Live over on 21st Street?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"What are you doing way over here?"
"Just walking. We came to see Piccola."
"Well, you better get on back. You can walk with Piccola. Come on in while I get the wash."
We stepped into the kitchen, a large, spacious room. Mrs. Breedlove's skin glowed like taffeta in the reflection of white porcelain, white woodwork, polished cabinets, and brilliant copperware. Odors of meat, vegetables, and something freshly baked mixed with the scent of Fels naphtha.
"I'm gonna get the wash. You all stand stock still, right there, and don't mess up nothing."
She disappeared behind a white swinging door, and we could hear the uneven flap of her footsteps as she descended into the basement. Another door opened, and in walked a little girl, smaller and younger than all of us. She wore a pink sunback dress and pink, fluffy bedroom slippers with two bunny ears pointed up from the tips. Her hair was corn yellow and bound in a thick ribbon. When she saw us, fear danced across her face for a second. She looked anxiously around the kitchen.
"Where's Polly?" she asked.
The familiar violence rose in me. Her calling Mrs. Breedlove Polly, when even Piccola called her mother Mrs. Breedlove, seemed reason enough to scratch her.
"She's downstairs," I said.
"Polly?" she called.
"Look," Frida whispered, "look at that."
On the counter Near the stove, in a silvery pan, was a deep-dish berry cobbler, the purple juice bursting here and there through crust. We moved closer. "It's still hot," Frida said. Piccola stretched her hand to touch the pan lightly to see if it was hot. "Polly, come here," the little girl called again. It may have been nervousness, awkwardness, but the pan tilted under Piccola's fingers and fell to the floor, splattering blackish blueberries everywhere. Most of the juice splashed on Piccola's legs, and the burn must have been painful, for she cried out and began hopping about, just as Mrs. Breedlove entered with a tightly packed laundry bag. In one gallop, she was on Piccola, and with the back of her hand, knocked her to the floor. Piccola slid in the pie juice, one leg folding under her. Mrs. Breedlove yanked her up by the arm, slapped her again, and in a voice thin with anger, abused Piccola directly, and Frida and me by implication. "Crazy fool, my floor mess. Look what you work, get on out. Now that crazy, my floor, my floor, my floor." Her words were hotter and darker than the smoking berries, and we backed away in dread. The little girl in pink started to cry. Mrs. Breedlove turned to her. "Hush, baby, hush. Come here. Oh, Lord, look at your dress. Don't cry no more. Polly will change it." She went to the sink and turned tap water on a fresh towel. Over her shoulder, she spit out words to us like rotten pieces of apple. "Pick up that wash and get on out of here so I can get this mess cleaned up." Piccola picked up the laundry bag, heavy with wet clothes, and we stepped hurriedly out the door. As Piccola put the laundry bag in the wagon, we could hear Mrs. Breedlove hushing and soothing the tears of the little pink and yellow girl. "Who were they, Polly?" "Don't worry none, baby. You gonna make another pie?" "Course I will." "Who were they, Polly?" "Hush, don't worry none," she whispered, and the honey in her words complimented the sundown spilling on the lake. "See, Mother, Mother is very nice. Mother, will you play with Jane?" Mother laughs. "Laugh, Mother, laugh. Laugh." The easiest thing to do would be to build a case out of her foot. That is what she herself did. But to find out the truth about how dreams die, one should never take the word of the dreamer. The end of her lovely beginning was probably the cavity in one of her front teeth. She preferred, however, to think always of her foot. Although she was the 9th of 11 children and lived on a ridge of red Alabama clay 7 miles from the nearest road, the complete indifference with which a rusty nail was met when it punched clear through her foot during her second year of life saved Pauline Williams from total anonymity. The wound left her with a crooked, archless foot that flopped when she walked, not a limp that would have eventually twisted her spine, but a way of lifting the bad foot as though she were extracting it from little whirlpools that threatened to pull it under. Slight as it was, this deformity explained for her many things that would have been otherwise incomprehensible. Why she alone, of all the children, had no nickname. Why there were no funny jokes and anecdotes about funny things she had done. Why no one ever remarked on her food preferences. No saving of the wing or neck for her. No cooking of the peas in a separate pot without rice because she did not like rice. Why nobody teased her. Why she never felt at home anywhere. or that she belonged any place. Her general feeling of separateness and unworthiness she blamed on her foot. Restricted as a child to this cocoon of her family's spinning, she cultivated quiet and private pleasures. She liked, most of all, to arrange things, to line things up in rows, jars on shelves at canning, peach pits on the step, sticks, stones, leaves, and the members of her family let these arrangements be. When by some accident somebody scattered her rose, they always stopped to retrieve them for her, and she was never angry, for it gave her a chance to rearrange them again. Whatever portable plurality she found, she organized into neat lines according to their size, shape, or gradations of color. Just as she would never align a pine needle with the leaf of a cottonwood tree, she would never put the jars of tomatoes next to the green beans. During all of her 4 years of going to school, she was enchanted by numbers and depressed by words. She missed, without knowing what she missed, paints and crayons. Near the beginning of World War I, the Williamses discovered, from returning neighbors and kin, the possibility of living better in another place, in shifts, lots, batches, mixed in with other families. They migrated in 6 months and 4 journeys to Kentucky, where there were mines and millwork. When all of us left from down home and was waiting down by the depot for the truck, it was nighttime. June bugs were shooting everywhere. They lighted up a tree leaf, and I seen a streak of green every now and then. That was the last time I seen real June bugs. These things up here ain't June bugs. They something else. Folks here call them fireflies. Down home they was different, but I recollect that streak of green. I recollect it well. In Kentucky, they lived in a real town, 10 to 15 houses on a single street, with water piped right into the kitchen. Ada and Fowler Williams found a 5-room frame house for their family. The yard was bounded by a once-white fence against which Pauline's mother planted flowers and within which they kept a few chickens. Some of her brothers joined the army. One sister died, and 2 got married, increasing the living space and giving the entire Kentucky venture a feel of luxury. The relocation was especially comfortable to Pauline, who was old enough to leave school. Mrs. Williams got a job cleaning and cooking for a white minister on the other side of town, and Pauline, now the oldest girl at home, took over the care of the house. She kept the fence in repair, pulling the pointed stakes erect, securing them with bits of wire, collected eggs, swept, cooked, washed, and minded the 2 younger children, a pair of twins called Chicken and Pie, who were still in school. She was not only good at housekeeping, she enjoyed it. After her parents left for work and the other children were at school or in mines, the house was quiet. The stillness and isolation both calmed and energized her. She could arrange and clean without interruption until 2 o'clock, when Chicken and Pie came home. When the war ended and the twins were 10 years old, they too left school to work. Pauline was 15, still keeping house, but with less enthusiasm. Fantasies about men and love and touching were drawing her mind and hands away from her work. Changes in weather began to affect her, as did certain sights and sounds. These feelings translated themselves to her in extreme melancholy. She thought of the death of newborn things, lonely roads, and strangers who appear out of nowhere simply to hold one's hand, woods in which the sun was always setting. In church especially did these dreams grow. The songs caressed her, and while she tried to hold her mind on the wages of sin, her body trembled for redemption, salvation, a mysterious rebirth that would simply happen with no effort on her part. In none of her fantasies was she ever aggressive. She was usually idling by the riverbank or gathering berries in a field when someone appeared with gentle and penetrating eyes who, with no exchange of words, understood, and before whose glance her foot straightened and her eyes dropped. The someone had no face, no form, no voice, no odor. He was a simple presence, an all-embracing tenderness with strength and a promise of rest. It did not matter that she had no idea of what to do or say to the presence after the wordless knowing and the soundless touching. Her dreams disintegrated, but the presence would know what to do. She had only to lay her head on his chest, and he would lead her away to the sea, to the city, to the woods, forever. There was a woman named Ivy who seemed to hold in her mouth all of the sounds of Pauline's soul. Standing a little apart from the choir, Ivy sang the dark sweetness that Pauline could not name. She sang the death-defying death that Pauline yearned for. She sang of the stranger who knew. Precious Lord, take my hand. Lead me on. Let me stand. I am tired. I am weak. I am worn. Through the storms, through the night, lead me on to the light. Take my hand, precious Lord, lead me on. When my way grows drear, precious Lord, linger near. When my life is almost gone, hear my cry, hear my call. Hold my hand, lest I fall. Take my hand, precious Lord, lead me on. Thus it was that when the stranger, the someone, did appear out of nowhere, Pauline was grateful, but not surprised. He came strutting right out of a Kentucky sun on the hottest day of the year. He came big. He came strong. He came with yellow eyes, flaring nostrils, and he came with his own music. Pauline was leaning idly on the fence, her arms resting on the cross rail between the pickets. She had just put down some biscuit dough and was cleaning the flour from under her nails. Behind her at some distance, she heard whistling, one of these rapid high note riffs that black boys make up as they go while sweeping, shoveling, or just walking along. A kind of city street music where laughter belies anxiety, and joy is as short and straight as the blade of a pocket knife. She listened carefully to the music and let it pull her lips into a smile. The whistling got louder, and still she did not turn around, for she wanted it to last. While smiling to herself and holding fast to the break in somber thoughts, she felt something tickling her foot. She laughed aloud and turned to see. The whistler was bending down, tickling her broken foot and kissing her leg. She could not stop her laughter, not until he looked up at her and she saw the Kentucky sun drenching the yellow, heavy-lidded eyes of Charlie Breedlove. "When I first see Charlie, I want you to know it was like all the bits of color from that time down home when all us children went berry picking after a funeral, and I put some in the pocket of my Sunday dress, and they mashed up and stained my hips. My whole dress was messed with purple, and it never did wash out, not the dress nor me. I could feel that purple deep inside me, and that lemonade Mama used to make when Pap came in out the fields. It'd be cool and yellowish, with seeds floating near the bottom. And that streak of green, them June bugs made on the trees, the night we left from down home. All of them colors was in me, just sitting there. So when Charlie come up and tickled my foot, it was like them berries, that lemonade, them streaks of green, the June bugs made all come together. Charlie was thin then, with real light eyes. He used to whistle, and when I heard him, shivers come on my skin. Pauline and Charlie loved each other. He seemed to relish her company, and even to enjoy her country ways and lack of knowledge about city things. He talked with her about her foot, and asked, when they walked through the town or in the fields, if she were tired. Instead of ignoring her infirmity, pretending it was not there, he made it seem like something special and endearing. For the first time, Pauline felt that her bad foot was an asset. And he did touch her, firmly but gently, just as she had dreamed, but minus the gloom of setting suns and lonely riverbanks. She was secure and grateful. He was kind and lively. She had not known there was so much laughter in the world. They agreed to marry and go way up north, where Charlie said steel mills were begging for workers. Young, loving, and full of energy, they came to Lorain, Ohio. Charlie found work in the steel mills right away, and Pauline started keeping house. And then she lost her front tooth. But there must have been a speck, a brown speck easily mistaken for food, but which did not leave, which sat on the enamel for months and grew until it cut into the surface and then to the brown putty underneath, finally eating away to the root, but avoiding the nerves, so its presence was not noticeable or uncomfortable. Then the weakened roots, having grown accustomed to the poison, responded one day to severe pressure, and the tooth fell free, leaving a ragged stump behind. But even before the little brown speck, there must have been the conditions, the setting, that would allow it to exist in the first place. In that young and growing Ohio town, whose side streets even were paved with concrete, which sat on the edge of a calm blue lake, which boasted an affinity with Oberlin, the Underground Railroad station just 13 miles away, this melting pot on the lip of America, facing the cold but receptive Canada, what could go wrong? Me and Charlie was getting along good then. We come up north, supposed to be more jobs and all. We moved into two rooms up over furniture store, and I set about housekeeping. Charlie was working at the steel plant, and everything was looking good. I don't know what all happened. Everything changed. It was hard to get to know folks up here, and I miss my people. I weren't used to so much white folks. The ones I seed before was something hateful, but they didn't come around too much. I mean, we didn't have too much truck with them, just now and then in the fields or at the commissary, but they weren't all over us. Up north, they was everywhere, next door, downstairs, all over the streets, and colored folks few and far between. Northern colored folk was different, too. Dicty-like. No better than whites for meanness. They could make you feel just as no count, except I didn't expect it from them. That was the lonesomest time of my life. I remember looking out them front windows, just waiting for Charlie to come home at 3 o'clock. I didn't even have a cat to talk to. In her loneliness, she turned to her husband for reassurance, entertainment, for things to fill the vacant places. Housework was not enough. There were only 2 rooms and no yard to keep or move about in. The women in the town wore high-heeled shoes, and when Pauline tried to wear them, they aggravated her shuffle into a pronounced limp. Charlie was kindness still, but began to resist her total dependence on him. They were beginning to have less and less to say to each other. He had no problem finding other people and other things to occupy him. Men were always climbing the stairs asking for him, and he was happy to accompany them, leaving her alone. Pauline felt uncomfortable with the few black women she met. They were amused by her because she did not straighten her hair. When she tried to make up her face as they did, it came off rather badly. Their goading glances and private snickers at her way of talking, saying children, and dressing developed in her a desire for new clothes. When Charlie began to quarrel about the money she wanted, she decided to go to work. Taking jobs as a day worker helped with clothes and even a few things for the apartment, but it did not help with Charlie. He was not pleased with her purchases and began to tell her so. Their marriage was shredded with quarrels. She was still no more than a girl, and still waiting for that plateau of happiness, that hand of a precious lord, who, when her way grew drear, would always linger near. Only now she had a clearer idea of what drear meant. Money became the focus of all their discussions, hers for clothes, his for drink. The sad thing was that Pauline did not really care for clothes and makeup. She merely wanted other women to cast favorable glances her way. After several months of doing day work, she took a steady job in the home of a family of slender means and nervous, pretentious ways. Charlie commenced to get meaner and meaner and wanted to fight me all the time. I gave him as good as I got, had to. Looked like working for that woman and fighting Charlie was all I did, tiresome. But I held on to my jobs, even though working for that woman was more than a notion. It wasn't so much her meanness as just simple-minded. Her whole family was. Couldn't get along with one another worth nothing. You'd think with a pretty house like that, and all the money they could hold on to, they would enjoy one another. She'd haul off and cry over the leastest thing. If one of her friends cut her short on the telephone, she'd go to crying. She should have been glad she had a telephone. I ain't got one yet. I recollect once how her baby brother, who she put through dentistry school, didn't invite them to some big party he throwed. There was a big to-do about that. Everybody stayed on the telephone for days, fussing and carrying on. She asked me, "Pauline, what would you do if your own brother had a party and didn't invite you?" I said, "If I really wanted to go to that party, I reckon I'd go anyhow, never mind what he want." She just sucked her teeth a little and made out like what I said was dumb. All the while, I was thinking how dumb she was. Whoever told her that her brother was her friend? Folks can't like folks just 'cause they has the same mama. I tried to like that woman myself. She was good about giving me stuff, but I just couldn't like her. Soon as I worked up a good feeling on her account, she'd do something ignorant, start into telling me how to clean and do. If I left her on her own, she'd drown in dirt. I didn't have to pick up after chicken and pie the way I had to pick up after them. None of them knew so much as how to wipe their behinds. I know, 'cause I did the washing, and couldn't pee proper to save their lives. Her husband ain't hit the bowl yet. Nasty white folks is about the nastiest things they is. But I would have stayed on, excepting for Charlie come over by where I was working and cut up so. He come there drunk, wanting some money. When that white woman see him, she turned red. She tried to act strong-like, but she was scared bad. Anyway, she told Charlie to get out or she would call the police. He cussed her and started pulling on me. I would have gone upside his head, but I don't want no dealings with the police. So I'd taken my things and left. I tried to get back, but she didn't want me no more if I was going to stay with Charlie. She said she would let me stay if I left him. I thought about that. But later on, it didn't seem none too bright for a black woman to leave a black man for a white woman. She didn't ever give me the $11 she owed me, neither. That hurt bad. The gas man had cut the gas off, and I couldn't cook none. I really begged that woman for my money. I went to see her. She was mad as a wet hen, kept on telling me I owed her for uniforms and some old broken-down bed she'd give me. I don't know if I owed her or not, but I needed my money. She wouldn't let up none, neither. Even when I give her my word that Charlie wouldn't come back there no more. Then I got so desperate, I asked her if she would loan it to me. She was quiet for a spell. And then she told me I shouldn't let a man take advantage over me, that I should have more respect, and it was my husband's duty to pay the bills. And if he couldn't, I should leave him and get alimony. All such simple stuff. What was he gonna give me alimony on? I seen she didn't understand that all I needed from her was my $11 to pay the gas man so I could cook. She couldn't get that one thing through her thick head. Are you gonna leave him, Pauline? She kept on saying. I thought she'd give me my money if I said I would. So I said, yes, ma'am. All right, she said. You leave him and then come back to work and we'll let bygones be bygones. Can I have my money today? I said. No, she said. Only when you leave him. I'm only thinking of you and your future. What good is he, Pauline? What good is he to you? How are you going to answer a woman like that who don't know what good a man is and say out of one side of her mouth she's thinking of your future? But won't give you your own money so you could buy you something besides bologna to eat. So I said, no good, ma'am. He ain't no good to me. But just the same, I think I'd best stay on. She got up and I left. When I got outside, I felt pains in my crotch. I had held my legs together so tight, trying to make that woman understand. But I reckon now she couldn't understand. She married a man with a slash in his face instead of a mouth. So how could she understand? One winter, Pauline discovered she was pregnant. When she told Charlie, he surprised her by being pleased. He began to drink less and come home more often. They eased back into a relationship more like the early days of their marriage when he asked if she were tired or wanted him to bring her something from the store. In this state of ease, Pauline stopped doing day work and returned to her own housekeeping. But the loneliness in those two rooms had not gone away. When the winter sun hit the peeling green paint of the kitchen chairs, when the smoked hocks were boiling in the pot, when all she could hear was the truck delivering furniture downstairs, she thought about back home, about how she had been all alone most of the time then too, but that this lonesomeness was different. Then she stopped staring at the green chairs, at the delivery truck. She went to the movies instead. There in the dark, her memory was refreshed, and she succumbed to her earlier dreams. Along with the idea of romantic love, she was introduced to another, physical beauty, probably the most destructive ideas in the history of human thought. Both originated in envy, thrived in insecurity, and ended in disillusion. In equating physical beauty with virtue, she stripped her mind, bound it, and collected self-contempt by the heap. She forgot lust and simple caring for. She regarded love as possessive mating and romance as the goal of the spirit. It would be for her a wellspring from which she would draw the most destructive emotions, deceiving the lover and seeking to imprison the beloved, curtailing freedom in every way. She was never able, after her education in the movies, to look at a face and not assign it some category in the scale of absolute beauty, and the scale was one she absorbed in full from the silver screen. There at last were the darkened woods, the lonely roads, the river banks, the gentle, knowing eyes. There the flawed became whole, the blind sighted, and the lame and halt threw away their crutches. There death was dead, and people made every gesture in a cloud of music. There the black and white images came together, making a magnificent whole, all projected through the ray of light from above and behind. It was really a simple pleasure, but she learned all there was to love and all there was to hate. The onlyest time I'd be happy seemed like was when I was in the picture show. Every time I got, I went. I'd go early, before the show started. They'd cut off the lights and everything be black. Then the screen would light up, and I'd move right on in them pictures. White men taking such good care of their women, and they all dressed up in big, clean houses, with the bathtubs, right in the same room with the toilet. Them pictures gave me a lot of pleasure. But it made coming home hard, and looking at Charlie hard. I don't know. I remember one time I went to see Clark Gable and Jean Harlow. I fixed my hair up like I'd seen hers on a magazine, a part on the side with one little curl on my forehead. It looked just like her. Well, almost just like. Anyway, I sat in that show with my hair done up that way and had a good time. I thought I'd see it through to the end again. And I got up to get me some candy. I was sitting back in my seat, and I'd taken a big bite of that candy, and it pulled a tooth right out of my mouth. I could have cried. I had good teeth, not a rotten one in my head. I don't believe I ever did get over that. There I was, 5 months pregnant, trying to look like Jean Harlow, and a front tooth gone. Everything went then. Looked like I just didn't care no more after that. I let my hair go back, plaited it up, and settled down to just being ugly. I still went to the pictures, though, but the meanness got worse. I wanted my tooth back. Charlie poked fun at me, and we started fighting again. I tried to kill him. He didn't hit me too hard 'cause I were pregnant, I guess. But the fights, once they got started up again, kept up. He began to make me madder than anything I knowed, and I couldn't keep my hands off him. Well, I had that baby, a boy, and after that got pregnant again with another one. But it weren't like I thought it was gonna be. I loved them and all, I guess. But maybe it was having no money, or maybe it was Charlie. But they sure worried the life out of me. Sometimes I'd catch myself hollering at them and beating them, and I'd feel sorry for them, but I couldn't seem to stop. When I had the second one, a girl, I remember I said I'd love it no matter what it looked like. She looked like a black ball of hair. I don't recollect trying to get pregnant that first time. But that second time, I actually tried to get pregnant. Maybe because I'd had one already and wasn't scared to do it. Anyway, I felt good and wasn't thinking on the carrying, just the baby itself. I used to talk to it whilst it be still in the womb. Like good friends we was, you know. I'd be hanging wash, and I knowed lifting weren't good for it. I'd say to it, hold on now, I gonna hang up these few rags, don't get froggy, it'd be over soon. It wouldn't leap for nothing. Or I'd be mixing something in a bowl for the other child, and I'd talk to it then too. You know, just friendly talk. On up till the end. I felt good about that baby. I went to the hospital when my time come, so I could be easeful. I didn't want to have it at home, like I done with the boy. They put me in a big room, with a whole mess of women. The pains was coming, but not too bad. A little old doctor come to examine me. He had all sorts of stuff. He gloved his hand, and put some kind of jelly on it, and rammed it up between my legs. When he left off, some more doctors come. One old one, some young ones. The old one was learning the young ones about babies, showing them how to do. When he got to me, he said, now, these here women, you don't have any trouble with. They deliver right away and with no pain, just like horses. The young one smiled a little. They looked at my stomach and between my legs. They never said nothing to me. Only one looked at me. Looked at my face, I mean. I looked right back at him. He dropped his eyes and turned red. He knowed, I reckon, that maybe I weren't no horse foaling. But them others, they didn't know. They went on. I seed them talking to them white women. How you feel? Gonna have twins? Just shucking them, of course. But nice talk. Nice, friendly talk. I got edgy. And when them pains got harder, I was glad. Glad to have something else to think about. I moaned something awful. The pains wasn't as bad as I let on. But I had to let them people know having a baby was more than a bowel movement. I hurt, just like them white women. Just cause I wasn't hooping and hollering before didn't mean I wasn't feeling pain. What'd they think? That just cause I knowed how to have a baby with no fuss, that my behind wasn't pulling and aching like theirs? Besides, that doctor didn't know what he was talking about. He must never seed no mare foal. Who say they don't have no pain? Just cause she don't cry? Cause she can't say it? They think it ain't there? If they looks in her eyes and see them eyeballs lolling back, see the sorrowful look, they'd know. Anyways, the baby come. Big, old, healthy thing. She looked different from what I thought. Reckon I talked to it so much before, I conjured up a mind's eye view of it. So when I seed it, it was like looking at a picture of your mama when she was a girl. You knows who she is, but she don't look the same. They give her to me for a nursing, and she liked to pull my nipple off right away. She caught on fast. Not like Sammy, he was the hardest child to feed. But Picola looked like she knowed right off what to do. A right smart baby she was. I used to like to watch her. You know they makes them greedy sounds, eyes all soft and wet, a cross between a puppy and a dying man. But I knowed she was ugly, head full of pretty hair. But Lord, she was ugly. When Sammy and Picola were still young, Pauline had to go back to work. She was older now, with no time for dreams and movies. It was time to put all the pieces together, make coherence where before there had been none. The children gave her this need. She herself was no longer a child. So she became, and her process of becoming was like most of ours. She developed a hatred.